From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how Michigan is failing special education students.
The state is responsible for making sure that children with disabilities have access to an appropriate education, and they need to step up and do that.
The health risks of PFAS chemicals.
PFASs are clearly linked to toxicity of the liver, the immune system, and endocrine systems, as well as the developing fetus and newborns. There's evidence in both animals and humans.
A creative way to match artists with the public.
What if we created a platform that enabled people to interact and engage with each other on an individual basis, but not utilizing money?
And West Michigan music in local spins.
We've had hip-hop on this show, but Christian rap is something new.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When it comes to special education, Michigan schools are not performing well. A recent report from the U.S. Department of Education found Michigan was the only state failing enough federal special ed requirements to be considered in need of federal intervention. Tomorrow on Statewide Count Day, special ed advocates are rallying at the state capitol to demand action to improve services for students with special needs. Joining us now, Mark McWilliams, an attorney with Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services. Mark, what do you feel are the policies and decisions that set our state on this course that's so dismal when it comes to special education?
Well, thank you, Cindy, for having me on. I think there are lots of people who are working really hard to try to serve students. I think the system is starved for resources, not just schools, but mental health services, housing, transportation, and job support. These are problems that exist around the country, but Michigan has especially struggled. The numbers speak for themselves.
When I think of how many years you've done this work, many years, have things gotten better or worse in your view?
I think that we've seen some improvements in some very specific areas. Our agency, for example, for a number of years has worked on trying to improve the complaint investigation process. And we've seen some improvements in how the state focuses on systemic issues within districts and how they focus on substantive issues that affect actual outcomes for students with disabilities. What we haven't seen happen is once there are problems that are identified, we haven't seen a focus on improving student outcomes, not just for individual students, but for all students in a district when problems are identified.
And to the point where, as I mentioned, the Federal Department of Education says Michigan needs intervention. How much of a difference do you think this federal intervention would make?
Well, it depends on what kind of intervention they're talking about. I think that there needs to be a focus on outcomes not just at the state level, but also at the federal level. There needs to be a focus on how the entire system is supported and what the goals are. There are new court decisions that have come out within the last year that have increased the standards that schools will be held to in providing an appropriate education and in providing education in the least restrictive environment. And more than ever, the focus at both the state and the federal level needs to be on student outcomes and bringing the outcomes up to where you see students without disabilities.
And how do you see that happening? If you could craft a system that would be the best system possible for these students with the special needs, what would it look like?
Well, I would start by asking a question about what works for all students. And many of the things that work for all students are things that can also work for students with disabilities. There have been a number of state task forces that have issued findings on how to improve general education for students without disabilities. They focus on teacher quality. They focus on support in the educational environment. They focus on things like positive behavior supports for students with challenging disability-related behavior. And those kinds of interventions, in my view, can go a long way toward also improving educational outcomes for students with disabilities.
Give us an example, Mark, if you could, of a typical case where you would work on for a family with a special needs student. What are the kinds of barriers that they smack up against in getting their kids the help they need?
Okay, so most of our students are students with challenging behaviors. They may be students that are labeled as emotionally impaired, and because of their disability, they're struggling to participate in school. They're struggling to stay in school. And often they find themselves either pushed out of school for part of a day or sometimes all of a day. Sometimes they're put on homebound instruction 2 hours a week. sometimes they're put on partial school days and they're asked to earn their way back into a full school day. And this is all for behavior that is often related to their disability and behavior that probably could be redirected and brought to an end through evidence-based practices like positive behavior supports. So what we do is we talk to students, we talk to the parents, we get educational records. We may file a complaint, which is just a letter with the State Department of Education, asking them to investigate and find that the school needs to provide more appropriate services to support the students in school. That complaint process is pretty fast. It's about 60 calendar days. Then once the finding comes back, as I say, we're getting more success in the state finding that schools need to do more. The next step, though, is they need to then get involved to make sure that the school is doing what's necessary to get the kid back in school and get them growing and learning again.
Here's what I'm wondering about the fact that there's this rally tomorrow on statewide count day. What's the message of the rally, and how do you think we can hold the state accountable for the poor condition of special education in Michigan?
Well, I think that you're going to have a variety of speakers who are going to have a variety of suggestions on what to do about improving education. It's not just about education, first of all. It's also about the community supports that students and parents get in school, mental health services, affordable housing, transportation, especially for older students, employment and work supports to make sure that they have the skills ready to be part of the working world once they're out. That's a big part of it. I think the state needs to get involved directly. You know, there's a proposal. I know that they are trying to delegate some of the responsibilities to the intermediate school districts. And, you know, the state is responsible for making sure that children with disabilities have access to an appropriate education. And they need to step up and do that.
Mark McWilliams, an attorney with the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
The Michigan Department of Education sent us a statement reading in part, and I quote, "We are committed to providing a quality education for all students in Michigan, including those with special needs. The Michigan Department of Education's work to become a top 10 education state in 10 years is designed to better support intermediate school districts to address local school district improvements. We are in the process of moving in a new direction to improve educational outcomes for students with disabilities." County prosecutors in Michigan are warning of a resurgence of methamphetamine throughout the state. And they say the latest incarnation of the drug is much more potent, much more addictive than it used to be. The meth sold on the streets these days usually does not come from homemade labs. It's imported from places like Mexico. Interlochen Public Radio's Aaron Selbig reports.
It's late morning and Leah is making a cup of tea. She's dressed, her makeup is done, she's ready for her day.
I am a mother, I am an artist, I am a lot of things, but I also struggle with the disease of addiction, and that has really compromised most of my adult life.
Leah has asked that we not use her last name because she's trying to win more visitation time with her daughter. Shortly after her daughter's birth, Leah had postpartum depression. That's when she used methamphetamine for the first time.
You feel like you're just on top of the world and you can do anything. And I feel creative, I feel competent, but it's also deceiving because you're just a hot mess.
A couple of years after she started using meth, Leah was caught up in a drug raid at a house in Benzie County. She says police busted down the door and rushed in with guns drawn.
And I said thank you to them because I was just so grateful to not be stuck in that addiction.
Leah got clean in jail, and then when she got out, she went back to the drugs. But this time something was different. Instead of cooking meth using the bottle method, where you mix ingredients and shake them up in a plastic bottle, people were using crystal meth, or ice. Law enforcement officials say ice is mass-produced in laboratories, usually in the southwestern U.S. or Mexico. And ice is much more powerful than the old bottle method meth. It took Leah by surprise.
I've never had this happen, but I was too high, and I was freaking out because It was just way too much.
Crystal meth use is skyrocketing, according to county prosecutors in five northern counties. Marquette County has prosecuted more than 100 meth felonies this year. That's more than 2016 and 2017 combined. In Wexford County, the amount of meth seized by police went from 12 grams, a small handful, to over 400 grams in just 1 year. County Prosecutor Jason Elmore says for the last year and a half, a drug pipeline has been carrying imported crystal meth north from Kalamazoo.
Crystal meth is cheap. Crystal meth is very prevalent. And because it's cheaper than heroin, we have a lot more people on that crystal meth.
Elmore says meth has a relatively low street value. It's about one quarter the price of heroin. He says heroin and prescription opioids are still around, but nothing is spiking like crystal meth. Pam Lynch is a clinical therapist who runs Harm Reduction Michigan, a nonprofit addiction services agency in Traverse City.
It found a way in because the establishment was distracted by the opiate epidemic.
Lynch says drug trends tend to move in cycles. A crackdown on one drug, like bottle method meth, may lead to abuse of heroin, and a spike in the price of heroin may lead people to a cheaper, more potent alternative, like crystal meth.
No human society has ever existed without some sort of mind-altering substances, you know, and historically it goes back for decades.
But meth is different than other drugs, says Lynch. It may not produce as many fatal overdoses as heroin or fentanyl, but because of its chemical makeup, meth takes a destructive toll on people over time.
These are chemicals that really don't have any place in a human body. You know, everything from acetone, all kinds of nasty corrosive chemicals that are used to make methamphetamine.
Leah is taking her tea downstairs to her bedroom. Because of years of meth use, she's lost most of her teeth and is partially blind. She's trying to get clean, with mixed results.
It's actually been a couple days. I'm on day four, which normally I can't get past day two.
She says she takes each day one at a time. Lots of tea and coffee help. One day, she says she'd like to be a stable mother for her daughter.
Yeah, it's hard, but I'm doing the best I can, so.
For Stateside, I'm Aaron Selbig.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time to listen to some of the good music being made in West Michigan. John Sinkovich is editor and publisher of Local Spins. And John, we're starting with a folk rock band you call much respected, grungy, and atmospheric.
This is Big Duty Roo, and this is a band that's actually evolved over the years. They've been together for several years. They started as a high school band, these three guys, Max Lockwood, Justin Dory, and Nate Wagner, and they've become a little grungier and a little heavier as they've gone on, but I do say that their latest single has a little bit of a pop flavor to it as well, and part of that, I think, is because Max Lockwood is involved in so many other projects. You know, he's toured with May Erlewine and a lot of other Michigan bands, and he also fronts a Tom Petty tribute band called The Insiders. And this band has grown to be really popular among audiences here in the West Michigan area, partly because they put on great live shows. They really turned it on recently at the Harvest Gathering up north, which was one of the festivals in September.
All right, so with that in mind, I'm going to invite everybody now to check out a track from their new EP, Duty Bound. This is Breathe. So now I know why I hear a strong echo of Tom Petty in this track.
Yeah, Max even has some of the intonation of Tom Petty, especially when he does the Insiders tribute. But it's interesting, too, because I think part of it is they mesh a lot of different sounds, and they're definitely influenced by Pearl Jam and the grunge band movement as well. So it's a real interesting, groovy listening kind of a thing. They're going to be playing a special standing room only show on Friday at Seven Steps Up in Spring Lake, which is usually a listening room. But this is going to be kind of a fun rock and roll party.
And I have to say, for those of us who have not
heard of this band, and so you're hearing us say Big Doody Roo. It's D-U-D-E-E-R-O-O. I love the name, and that lets them have some fun with titles of their EPs.
Yes, including things like Duty Free and Duty Bound and Heavy Duty. So they enjoy themselves on stage and in the way they write.
Great. Over to a Grand Rapids singer-songwriter, Ford Terrell. Tell us about Ford.
This I consider truly an under-the-radar pick because I was unaware of Ford Terrell up until this album, and partly because he spent 6 years in Nashville as part of the songwriting factory, as he calls it, but he left Nashville, moved back to Grand Rapids to raise his family, and hasn't released an album in 11 years. And I'm telling you, he went back to Nashville to record this, spent a lot of time crafting these songs, and it is impressive from start to finish. Insightful stuff about his life and about the way life changes as you move into your 20s and 30s. And I have to say that I was very impressed by the way he has crafted these songs, but also brought in a lot of elements that are not necessarily country, but more indie folk and indie rock into his music.
The new album is Days Go By, so let's check out that title track from that album. Here's Days Go By.
Cover my scars up. Is it I can't see my reflection, but I don't know who I am. I get desperate. I get baptized.
Must have really taken away some great lessons from being part of that so-called Nashville songwriting factory.
He said it was an eye-opening experience. It was the first time he'd collaborated with other writers and their editors in the room, and he had to learn how to be really concise in his songwriting. And that means jettisoning anything that wasn't absolutely essential to a song, whether it was lyrics or part of a melody. And he really learned how to find the hook in a song, because that's really what commercial country is all about. It's all about the hooks.
And where can we check out? Is he got any performances coming up?
He just performed this past weekend in Grand Rapids as part of his album release show. He's also performing on October 20th at Tavern 101 in Bay City, and then again back here in Grand Rapids on November 7th at Buffalo Traders Lounge.
And now to a genre I don't believe that you have brought to us so far on Local Spins, Christian rap.
Yes, we've had hip-hop on this show, but Christian rap is something new. But this guy, Stephen Malcolm, has really drawn a lot of attention nationally for his music, and the music is amazing. He has a very smooth style to him, and at the same time, a very infectious and melodic hooks that have really earned him attention and a lot of major accolades. He's already toured nationally with Lecrae and Andy Mineo, among others. He was part of the Winter Jam Tour. Last year, he was nominated for 3 Dove Awards, including New Artist of the Year and Rap Hip Hop Album of the Year, and he's also the first hip-hop artist signed to Word Entertainment, which features such big names as Skillet and Switchfoot and Sidewalk Profits. And his singles and his videos for his singles have gotten tons and hundreds of thousands of views, including the most recent video for Fuego that has racked up more than 500,000 views so far on YouTube.
Well, let's take a listen to some of Fuego. Here's Stephen Malcolm.
This here the second city for those who think it, we do not got it on lock with no key. We are the prodigy. We are the anomaly. Strengthen the outnumbered. We are IPAB. We are slightly crazy. We are Patrick Swayze. We go and ghost till the endo, but we do not endo. Joe told me snap. I'm like Lego. Hype beats all over that Fuego. Work all on the table. Yeah, my bro's on payroll. Hey, tell him goons are lay low. Yeah, just keep it fresh, go.
John, tell us Stephen's backstory.
So he started writing and rapping kind of as a teen. After a difficult childhood, he was inspired by everything from Michael Jackson to Snoop Dogg to Lil Wayne to Drake. But when he attended a hip-hop church in Grand Rapids, it changed everything, changed his outlook on life. He saw all these young people that are really interested in the church environment, and he started rapping and creating these videos via social media, and got all kinds of attention from major labels, and the rest, as they say, is history. And he really focuses on making these things sound like real mainstream rap songs, and yet they have an amazing message to them as well. He collaborates frequently with DJ Mark Evans, and he's been touring all over the country. This month alone, he's playing in Florida, Arkansas, Texas, Colorado, Wisconsin, and elsewhere.
Ooh, so again, as you say, the national buzz is certainly growing for Stephen Malcolm.
Absolutely. And I think this is only the beginning for him, because this is the tip of the iceberg. He's just now really making that splash. I really see a lot more ahead for this guy.
John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of Local Spins, where you can find all kinds of information on these and other West Michigan artists. Always fun talking with you, John.
Thanks so much.
Take one artist trying to build a portfolio or perhaps searching for studio space. Add in someone who's got the space and wants more art or music or dance in his or her life. Match them up, and you've got ArtShare, a brand new online platform that wants to be the bridge to connect people through the arts. Aaron Dworkin is the founder and president of ArtShare, and he's a professor at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance and the Ross School of Business. Aaron, welcome to Stateside.
It's so great to be here with you.
You know, your fields of interest and study are, to me, are basically where the arts and entrepreneurship intersect, as we see in ArtShare. Am I onto something here?
Absolutely. And I guess in a way I kind of fell into it. I wasn't kind of looking at it going, I'm going to be an arts entrepreneur. But rather, because I think this is what happens in the arts, there was an issue. And at the time for me, it was related to diversity and classical music, since I was a violinist. And there were these issues. And it was the question of how could I help address them? How could I move the field forward? And so then that leads you to build an enterprise to address that.
And the issues were?
Well, for that, just the complete lack of diversity. And so how could I work to increase it, and instead of just complaining about it? And so this manifests for so many of my current students in, you know, looking at their instrument and being, how can I build a chamber ensemble? How could I build connections to a community? How could I build a teaching studio? Or how could I actually build an organization to address a particular issue? And so the thing that unfortunately wasn't existent at the time when I was a student, for the most part, but is that we do have skill sets that we can train. We can provide education specifically to build these skill sets in our students so that they're better prepared to build a sustainable enterprise around their art making.
And so how does ArtShare do this?
And so this is literally, I guess, my own arts entrepreneurship in the making. And so I get to, while I teach it in the classroom, my students get to witness me practicing it in the field directly.
And building it.
But this came out of this idea that there are so many artists whose incredible talents are underutilized. There is more art making that they could do if given the opportunity, the platform. And when we looked at that, and we looked at how many people there are in the community who want to access artists, but unless it's through a traditional institution, a presenter, an orchestra, a dance company, a theater company, or whatever it might be, how could they access those arts in a more individualized way? And so this was the idea of, well, what if we created a platform that enabled people to interact and engage with each other on an individual basis, but not utilizing money to say, okay, I want to book you as an artist, because there are some current platforms that can do that. I want a band to come and play
Absolutely.
For a wedding. But rather to say, there's something that I have of value. It could be airline miles. And I have miles. But you know what? I also, my youngest really needs to begin piano lessons. So then there could be a teacher who's able to provide that incredible artistic offering, and in exchange for something that is of value for them. And so this idea that could we really create really almost this bartering exchange that would not only enable on an individualized basis artists to acquire and access more opportunities and people to access artists, but as a whole to better utilize the artistic ecosystem we have, to basically, if you will, increase the artistic production that we're capable of as a society. So that's the goal, the idea, and we're just launching, so we'll see how that develops.
And it's doing it in a very, very on the ground, you know, micro level, not going to a concert hall to hear a symphony, but perhaps, as you say, having that person come to give violin lessons to your youngster or to you. Let's say you've always wanted to learn. And so what might be some other things of value? You mentioned airline miles.
Yeah. So, and this could also be, so some, you know, local small businesses could be involved. So there could be a business that would say, you know what, we'd love to have a jazz ensemble in once or twice a week. And maybe in exchange for X number of meals that we have, right? They could balance something like that out. There's I know several years ago for my wife for our anniversary, I brought in a violinist who was just from the school to come and play in our backyard and kind of surprise her as we were just sitting there. But that was just because I happened to, of course, know musicians at the school and that kind of thing. So here, someone could just literally bring that out, and maybe it's in exchange for staying. So whereas someone with Airbnb, they're trading space for money, here they could potentially trade it for artistic offerings in their home. So there's a host of different things. And as we began to kind of vet the idea out, we began to hear these stories of where people are already doing this on a one-to-one basis. Oh, yeah, I had someone stay with me for a month, and they gave some lessons, or they taught me, you know, how to play guitar. And this goes also to yoga or to healing arts. So there's a host of different categories that we've created on the site so that people can pretty much access any potential creative artistic service that they would desire.
And for that artist, I dare say that that popular image of the struggling artist is not very far removed from the reality of making a living, keeping a roof over your head. I'm just thinking of people that I know that I'm friends with where, you know, how am I going to make the rent this month, or how do I get studio space? So those practical concerns are a real thing. And this could be a way of maybe relieving some of that?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And one of the things that I teach my students relates to this idea to prepare for a portfolio life, that this idea that they'll just do one thing as a creative person is pretty rare these days. They will most likely build this portfolio. And our thought is that ArtShare can really help be a tool, a mechanism for a key part of an artist's portfolio.
Artists get something back, perhaps a practical, a place to stay or practice or work. But they're also getting a chance to exercise their art, exercise their craft.
And that is the underlying mission. Yes. That's what's driving it. The idea to be able to increase the opportunities for the artistic talents that we possess as a society to actually materialize and be realized.
So we really, your hope is, I can tell from what you're saying, that ArtShare is really going to reshape the way that we think of art and the role that arts can play in our everyday lives.
That is absolutely our hope and our wish and our dream. And so as we, you know, you kind of put things out there into the ether, if you will, of the internet, we've had some great teams working on all of the site development. And now it's in that phase of engaging people to build, if you will, that community who are posting and creating these opportunities. So, and I should say that's all, of course, free and all of that. And so it's just a platform that people are able to utilize.
And so how would people plug in? What are the next steps now that you've kind of, you're taking the wraps off this new baby, online baby?
Once we got past the initial ideation and we're looking at actually laying out some of the site design, my big mantra I kept sharing with everyone was simplicity, right? We wanted just, you know, like a Google interface where behind the scenes it's complex, but what people have to interface with is simple.
So and I checked it out, and it is. Yeah, it is like a Google search.
Exactly. That's what we wanted to be, very simple. So just to go to artshare.com, and you can either immediately create a post or search for a particular service and go from there.
So I could say, I want a piano teacher. That's step one.
Exactly.
Plug that in.
And you could either look under a category. So you could say, well, I'm just interested in something generally music. Mm-hmm. Or you can actually look for something very specific and use keyword search. Mm-hmm. So you can do either of those options. And we even want to, because we think sometimes people don't actually specifically know what it is they want, but they want to be inspired by something. They want to be moved in some way by the arts. So we literally have a surprise me button on the search. And that will just randomly finally generate something. No matter what, it will surprise you, and it could hopefully be something that will help connect and impact your life.
And either side of this equation can jump in. So the person looking for somebody in the arts and the artist with something to offer?
That's exactly true. So someone could just post who's looking for, I'm seeking someone to provide lessons. I'm seeking someone to come in and do weekly concerts in our house. I'm looking for someone to write a short story about our family. Anything, whatever it is, they can actually put, and in exchange for, here are the types of things that I might have to offer: housing, food, scholarship, mile, whatever that might be. And that's one of the things, is that we wanted to have as broad a platform as possible, because in the end, our hope is that we can't fully imagine what people will want to exchange. So we just want to create the platform and then let our users' talent and innovation drive where it goes.
Well, there it is, artshare.com. Aaron Dworkin is the founder and the president of ArtShare. He is also a professor at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance, and at the Ross School of Business. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Michigan is often called one of the most gerrymandered states in the country. Proposal 2 on this November's ballot is an attempt to change that. So, what questions do you have about Proposal 2? Because we want to know. Just go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org or call us at 734-764-7840 and leave your question. That's 734-764-7840. Stay with us. We've got questions about PFAS chemicals and the answers up next. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All this week, we are responding to your questions about PFAS, the latest environmental and water crises to hit the state. Many of the questions we received focused on the potential health effects of exposure to PFAS. So we turn to Dr. Courtney Kerrigan. She's an environmental exposure scientist and an epidemiologist at Michigan State University's Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition. Dr. Kerrigan, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start right at the ground floor, and I'll tell you, this question is not an uncommon one.
My name is Robert Heasley. I'm a Parchment resident, and my question about PFAS is there any actual evidence that it does a human being harm to have it in their blood? Because I haven't seen not one piece of evidence. I've seen a lot of speculation, but no evidence.
And certainly we should remind everybody, the town of Parchment in West Michigan, they actually were drinking bottled water at a point because of PFAS contamination. So, Professor, how do you answer a question like Robert's?
So, from my perspective in the scientific community, there's a lot of research that's been done about PFOA and POFOS in particular. There's thousands of scientific studies, and there's enough studies to say that exposure to PFAS is clearly linked to toxicity of the liver, the immune and endocrine systems, as well as the developing fetus and newborns. And this is why there is a health advisory for drinking water.
So these are health impacts that we know with certainty are linked to PFAS?
Well, so that's where it gets a little bit difficult in the communication aspect. To know for certain, we would have to do a randomized clinical trial, you know, expose people and then follow them and see what happens. We don't do that. That's obviously not ethical. Mm-hmm. So we can do observational human studies, and we can do studies with animals, and we can do studies using in vitro models. And when I say that PFASs are clearly linked to toxicity of the liver, the immune system, and endocrine systems, as well as the developing fetus and newborns, that's because there's evidence in both animals and humans.
So if I find out that I have a high level of PFAS in my water and I come to you and say, what diseases should I most be watchful for and most be concerned about, what would you tell me?
So the Seat Health Study, which was done for an exposed community in the Ohio River Valley, made medical monitoring recommendations, which included screening for high cholesterol, thyroid disease, testicular cancer, and kidney cancer.
And do we know when research on the effects of PFAS on human health first began? When did this come on science, the radar of science, if you will?
Well, there's studies from as early as the 50s that were done, I believe, on primate models that show effects on the immune system. But those were not really made public until recently. So I think research has been done for a long time, probably just for the past 10 years or so, there's been a lot more attention from the scientific community in trying to determine, you know, whether exposure to PFOA and PFOS in particular is safe or not.
Dr. Kerrigan, we also heard from a listener who grew up along the Kalamazoo River near Allegan. What should she think about a lifetime of PFAS exposure? How concerned should she be?
So it really depends on the amount of time that you were exposed, the time period in your life that you were exposed, and to the concentration that you were exposed to. If you have higher exposures or were exposed for a longer duration of time and were exposed prenatally or during early life, we would expect more health effects or people with exposures like that to be more likely to have health effects related to PFAS than people with lower exposures, exposed for a shorter duration of time or exposed only in adulthood.
And so the thing that's alarming, I'm sure, to people is how would they ever know that information?
Tricky communication. Yeah. My research group actually just got funded along with Northeastern and Silent Spring Institute to actually create some educational materials that are personalized for people so that they'd be able to put in their water concentration and we would be able to give them sort of a more personalized interpretation of what it means to have exposures at that level.
And I guess then let's say you are exposed. What's the to-do? What do I need to do as someone who has been ingesting water that has some level of these PFAS chemicals? What do I do next?
Right. So you can reduce your exposure by following the guidelines of drinking water that doesn't contain PFAS. So either, you know, drinking bottled water or installing a filtration system on your tap. Like I said, this resource that we're coming up with should help answer these questions.
What do I do as far as protecting or being vigilant about my health? What do I say to my doctor? What steps do I take at home if I've been living in a site that's found to have PFAS contamination?
The Agency of Toxic Substances and Disease Control Registry, they're part of CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and they have a physician fact sheet that I think the state health departments are sharing with local physicians. And so physicians in areas that have PFAS-impacted drinking water should have access to these fact sheets, and actually people can look them up online. They're available on ATSDR's website. So you can bring that to your physician. You could also get a hold of the C8 medical monitoring suggestions and bring that to your physician as well and discuss what kinds of things you could monitor for moving forward. I think it's helpful to know sort of what your exposures were in the context of what studies were done. Again, that's part of the communications that our group is going to be working on.
Are certain populations, let's say children or seniors, are they more susceptible to health problems from being exposed to PFAS?
Yes. So those exposed in utero or during early life may be more susceptible compared to an adult exposed to the same concentration for over the same period of time only during adulthood.
So where should future research be directed when we're talking about scientific research into PFAS exposure? Where should it be directed?
So more research is known about exposure in relation to health effects, prevention, and remediation to help answer questions of exposed communities. Also, while a lot of research has been done on PFOA and PFOS, we know little about other PFASs currently being used to create stain and water-resistant products.
Dr. Courtney Kerrigan is an assistant professor of food science and human nutrition, pharmacology, and toxicology at Michigan State University. Thank you so much, Dr. Kerrigan, for answering our listener questions about the health effects of PFAS exposure.
Thank you for having me.
The federal government is beefing up efforts to help children with cancer. President Trump signed the Childhood Cancer Survivorship Treatment Access and Research Act into law this past summer. Michigan physician Dr. David Dickens helped craft this STAR Act. He's a pediatric oncologist at Helen DeVos Children's Hospital in Grand Rapids. I recently sat down with Dr. Dickens to understand just what exactly the STAR Act hopes to achieve. When you stop and realize that cancer is the second leading cause of death for children aged 5 to 14, and some nearly 16,000 children aged birth to 19 are diagnosed with cancer every year in this country, it's really true this law matters deeply to a lot of families.
That's right. The leading cause of death in children due to disease is cancer. The leading one is accidents and suicide and homicide. So cancer is the disease that kills the most children. So there's a perception out there that this is no longer a problem because we've been so successful with some of our good stories. And over the course of my lifetime, we've really flipped the script on cure rates. When I was a child, my chance of being cured was roughly 1 in 4. Now it's up to 80%. So 80% cure rates, if you average all the children who come to get treated for cancer, are cured.
But in doing that, that creates kind of another series of challenges because people are living long lives with the effects of that treatment.
That's right. I think that there's two problems with that number 80%. One of them is that 80% is not 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And 20% of the children who come to our doors is a significant number. Anything less than 100% is something that we need to work against. The second problem is for many of the patients who are cured, in order to do so, we have to give them treatments that are very toxic. So the success stories that we have are baked into that is the fact that they were treated with some very toxic therapies and their chance of having other medical problems in the long term are very high.
When we talk about the STAR Act, what is it designed to give us that we don't have right now?
Better cures and better care. It's basically those components. In order for us to get better at what we do, we need better treatments. So part of this is designed to put into policy a way to bring better cures, safer cures, to children with cancer. Part of it is in designing a role for a pediatric cancer leader within the National Cancer Institute so that some of these studies are prioritized and some of the initiatives that are undertaken at the national level prioritize children with cancer research.
And it surprised me when I was reading up on the STAR Act to realize it will allow the National Institutes of Health to build a registry of pediatric cancer biospecimens. And I guess I kind of thought, wow, they don't already have that?
They have some, but they don't do a great job at tracking kids. So when I meet people on the worst day of their lives and they're presenting being told that their child has cancer, the first question that always hits their mind is, why did this happen to me? And the only thing that separates me from being on the other side of that bed is one important fact that keeps me up at night, which is I have no idea. So if we're ever going to get to the bottom of this, the best way to treat cancer is to not get it in the first place. And we have no idea why most of the cancers that hit children happen. Registries allow us to capture the information so that when somebody has a new idea, they can look into the data and try and understand why this is happening.
And then that just dovetails, I'm sure, into treatment and more research and more knowledge.
In order to make new discoveries, you have to have access to tissues. And most families I meet, when I talk with them at presentation, they're happy to do something to help other people. If the tumor that we take out can offer any information for the present or the future, children who are diagnosed with these diseases, they're happy to help. But we don't have a repository, a place where we put all of that stuff. So that if you are the researcher who has the new idea, you can turn to one place and say, I have this great idea. I would like to collect some tissue and some cancer specimens so I can do my research.
And Doctor, what's in the STAR Act that deals with survivorship?
So survivorship is the other part. It's how we care for people currently. So ideally, we would like to have better cures. But right now, all we have the ability to do is to cut, burn, and poison. I'm an oncologist, right? So chemotherapy, anybody who's received chemotherapy knows that it is a poison. I have a license to poison children, and I'm tired of it. It needs to be better. So right now, what we're dealing with is an epidemic of people who've been exposed to chemotherapy and have chronic health conditions. It's estimated there's going to be roughly 500,000 Americans in the United States, 500,000 people who are survivors of childhood cancer. Two-thirds of them are going to have some chronic health issue related to the things that we needed to do to cure them in the present time. So the system doesn't know what to do with people who have these special conditions. They've received treatments that cause these different unique side effects that need to be paid attention to. And when they graduate from our program and become young adults, they oftentimes will have barriers to getting access to the treatment that they need because the adult internists and the OBGYNs who are caring for these young adults don't have experience with the treatments they received as children.
So how does the STAR Act address that problem?
They are going to fund programs that are looking at novel or innovative ways and how do you integrate, build a bridge between the pediatric oncology teams who know what the problems are going to be and the primary care physicians who are handling the patients. So it's going to be open to anybody to innovate and to create programs that look at building some of the bridges that are going to lead to better care for survivors of childhood cancer.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with pediatric oncologist Dr. David Dickens. He's in Grand Rapids, and he was part of the team that crafted the Childhood Cancer Survivorship Treatment Access and Research Act. President Trump signed that into law earlier this summer. So, Doctor, it's a federal law, but you were there at the table helping to design it. So having that seat at the table, what could that mean for Michigan?
My hope is that we are positioned as good as any other state to capitalize on what's in the STAR Act to implement it in a way that is meaningful. So it's nice to have all the ideas in the world, but it's really the implementation sciences and how we craft these care models that's going to be important. And we are very gifted in this state in collaboration. So the key to all of this STAR Act has been collaboration. I'm not a politician. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm a content expert with the diseases that we treat. We needed people around the table who had all those different talents and gifts. And this has been a product of an alliance. The alliance is called the Alliance for Childhood Cancer. And it's required teamwork to get things done. And I'm proud of the fact that as a state, all the different institutions that treat pediatric cancer are connected and very collaborative in their spirit. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services has also been a collaborative team member when we have issues that are important to us. And I'm excited about the people who are there and the people who are at all the sites throughout Michigan, because we are poised very well to be the best at implementing what's in the law.
So the president signed this law this summer. Now what has to happen? And when I ask that, I'm thinking about money.
Correct. So here is the oncologist view on how things go, because it feels a little weird when a law is signed, but you can't do anything yet. And that's because it hasn't been funded. It's in appropriations is what it's called. So the Senate already met, and they've marked up their draft bill for the next fiscal year, and it includes a budget for $30 million for the STAR Act. And now it's sitting in the House waiting to be marked up for their bill, and I think that they're meeting this fall. If that goes through, which is expected because the co-sponsorship for the bill was bipartisan and majority, 80 to 90% of the representatives were co-sponsors on the bill. So it's expected that it's going to be funded. Once it gets funded, then the working groups right now are drafting white papers on what it needs to look like. And that's part of the process I'm working on now. I'll be in DC in October working with the groups to design what that actually looks like. And then hopefully shortly after that, after it gets appropriated, it would be open for people applying for their grants.
So if I am a family right now struggling with the challenges of having a child with cancer, what do you hope this STAR Act will mean for me, for my family?
Unfortunately, right now, it's going to take some time to see the benefits of this. I think that there's always reason to hope, regardless of what the disease is, regardless of what the prognosis is. Each and every child is going to be 100% cured or 0% cured. And when people who I work with go into work every day and do this work, they count on every child. You have to count on every child being cured. Otherwise, you can't get up in the morning. So there's always hope for each and every child. But this bill is hoping to make things better. And even if it's not better for the child who's presenting today, the hope is that there's people speaking up on your behalf. There's people all over the country who I'm collaborating with in this group who care about what's going on with your child and want to make things better.
Dr. David Dickens, pediatric oncologist at Helen DeVos Children's Hospital in Grand Rapids, part of the panel that crafted the Childhood Cancer Survivorship Treatment Access and Research Act. Doctor, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, and Isabella Isaacs. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.